So thanks a lot for this warm welcome and your kind introduction. And welcome to all of you, of course, to this lecture series, to today's lecture. I feel very honored to contribute to this series, and I look forward to spending the next 90 minutes with you. Before we actually start, if I start speaking too fast, which I tend to do sometimes, do interrupt me and just tell me, raise your hands. Also, if in the course of this lecture some questions come up, please also raise your hands, ask your questions, feel free to interrupt me at some point here. And apart from that, I hope that we will still have about 5 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes, in the end of this lecture for you to ask questions and to ask anything that might have not become clear in this lecture. So, as you can see on the slide here, today's topic is eco-criticism, with a subtitle, The Landscapes of Modernity in London Urban Poetry. I will present eco-criticism as a newly developing theory, and I will also apply this to urban poetry, particularly to London urban poetry. And finally, I would like to conclude by making some tentative suggestions of how this new and innovative theory could actually be put into practice, not only into practice by reading literature, but also into political and ethical practice, as we will see. But to illustrate in some more detail what this lecture is about, I would like to start by showing a short cartoon, and I hope that this works. We just tried it and it did, so let's see. Back to this. So this cartoon was taken from a documentary. Some of you might already know. It's a documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. The film was released in 2006, and it stars Al Gore, a former U.S.-American politician and currently, lifelong environmental activist. So just to remind you, Al Gore was U.S. Vice President from 1993 to 2001 and under President Bill Clinton, and he was also nominee for the Democrats in the presidential elections of 2000. So, is this still a... Yeah, okay. So, in these elections of 2000, you might also remember that Republican George W. Bush became president for the first time. And you might also remember this controversy surrounding the vote in Florida that was finally settled by the U.S. Supreme Court. So during his political time, during his vice presidency and his election campaign, Al Gore was already committed to environmental issues, and he then became engaged in environmental activism full-time, so to speak, when he withdrew from the political stage. He has numerous publications, and also, most famously, he stars in the film An Inconvenient Truth in 2006. And this film also won an Academy Award, an Oscar, in 2007. So also in 2007, Al Gore was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize together with the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. And in his acceptance speech, which was held on December 10th in 2007, he also draws attention to the fact that we, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential. So this planetary emergency constitutes the major theme of the film, An Inconvenient Truth, and it foregrounds, as we have just seen in the cartoon, the issue of global warming. This is one of the most pressing environmental concerns today, and also it has devastating effects on the entire planet. On this slide, again, you can see the poster of the film, and since Al Gore does a much better job at explaining what global warming is actually about, the mechanisms and the dangers, and also the effects, I think it is worthwhile at the outset of this lecture about eco-criticism to watch another episode from this film. It's a bit longer than the cartoon, it's about 4 minutes, and let's see whether this... So indeed, what would... Thank you. Hey. Thank you. What would that much on the warm side mean? And what could Gore's tentative question, or rather suggestive question, actually mean to us? And to contribute a bit more to ecological awareness, this is a quotation from the film's trailer from an advertisement, which says that humanity is sitting on a ticking time bomb, and if the vast majority of the world's scientists are right, we have just 10 years to avert a major catastrophe that could send our entire planet into a tailspin of epic destruction, involving extreme weather, floods, droughts, epidemics, and killer heat waves beyond anything we have ever experienced. So this spells out even more drastically what Al Gore also said in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. And to think about climate change, all these issues he mentions remind us of very recent news items. You might think of the polar ice caps melting and the poor polar bear will lose its habitat. But this will also, if we don't continue dropping ice cubes in the ocean, alter the Gulf Stream and change the global climate. There are water shortages, as you can see here, people gathering around a well or a farmer on his arid, arid plain. Wildfires and also floodings and, of course, storms or rainfalls. So these changes, as these drastic images and the film has already shown us, threaten our survival and have already led to migration from those areas that are really drastically affected to less affected countries like Europe, for instance. And it seems rather difficult to ignore or misinterpret these facts and these signs and to ignore the fact that our world is actually in danger. So climate protection has made it to the political agenda of most countries. There have been climate summits which are held in regular intervals, and you might remember the famous summit in Kyoto in 1997, which led to the Kyoto Protocol, which is a legally binding agreement which was signed by most leading countries of the world, though not by the United States, to actually counter climate change. And as a follow-up, very soon, this year's summit is scheduled to take place in Copenhagen in December, and it's supposed to be a renewal and an improvement of the Kyoto Protocol. But at the same time, and this is why I took this lengthy introduction to today's topic, ecological awareness has made it onto political agendas, but it is striking to note that in the humanities, for instance, there is very little regard for environmental concerns. So green issues have been rather slow to develop in the humanities, and Cheryl Glotfelty points out in her introduction to the Eco-Criticism Reader that while related humanities disciplines like history, philosophy, law, sociology, and religion have been greening since the 1970s, literary studies have apparently remained untainted by environmental concerns. And while social movements like the civil rights and women's liberation movements of the 60s and 70s have transformed literary studies, it would appear that the environmental movement of the same time has had little impact. So she continues, however, to outline that there have been rather few, but still there have been individual studies which have contributed to developing an ecologically informed criticism and theory in literary studies. And they have been rooted in the tradition of pastoralism, which you might be familiar with, and have taken into account the relationship between the environment and literature. And this is actually what we're going to do in today's lecture. Before that, I would like to say a few words about green issues in literary studies, because actually such green approaches to literature must face the same recurrent question all over again. So the question is basically a question that I have faced during my own studies and during my time as a PhD student and even today. And maybe you have also faced that from your parents or from friends. How can you actually study literature? How can you actually spend time reading when there are so many more important things to achieve? when, for instance, social sciences have a much more immediate and direct impact on the world. So how can literature play a significant role for sustainable climate protection would be one of the questions we could answer in literary studies. Another question would be, what can reading literature actually teach us about our relationship to the natural environment? And finally, which new theories, models, and methods can support such environmental activism, for instance, by putting theory into practice? And these are three guiding questions that I would like to that I would like you to keep in the back of your minds as we go along here. So for today, after this introduction, this lecture will outline the development of eco-criticism as an innovative, as a new approach to literary studies. So what is innovative is, for instance, the decidedly political dimension, which I just spelled out, and introducing this political dimension into the act of reading, which may then lead to an awareness of our moral responsibility to act. To illustrate this, we will move from this theoretical part to reading examples of urban poetry from such an eco-critical perspective, from an ecologically informed perspective. And in the end, I would like to demonstrate some more practical applications, or at least the practical activist dimension of this approach. Okay, but I think you've heard enough of theory for the time being, so I would like to turn to a reading of a poem at the outset of this development of eco-criticism. You can find this poem on your handout too. Your handout has two pages, or the one page has two sides, and on the back you can find all the poems that we're going to discuss here. So this is Arthur Symons' poem, City Nights. And I'll read it out to you. You can read along on your handout. The grey and misty night, slim trees that hold the night among their branches and along the vague embankment, light on light. The sudden racing lights, I can just hear, distinct, aloof, the gaily clattering hoof beating the rhythm of festive nights. The gardens to the weeping moon sigh back the breath of tears. Oh, the refrain of years on years 'neath the weeping moon. So for the discussion of this poem, I made a key, and you can refer to that key as we go along reading the poem. So as you can see on the slide, the poem was composed in 1896. So it's a poem of the fin de siècle era, and more precisely of the symbolist movement. I won't go into detail here. Let's focus on reading the poem as a text, and I will say some more about the contextualization in modernism or the fin de siècle era as we go along and later on in this lecture. So at first glance, this doesn't look like environmental literature, really. The title already says that City Nights... the title already indicates an urban setting. So environmental literature, one would probably think about as poetry about nature, like in the Romantic Age. But still, when we read this poem, this first impression is contradicted, because then words like night, trees, branches, but also gardens, then refer to the natural environment. And at the same time, well, the moon also belongs to the natural environment, and at the same time, the term embankment then signals that the setting of the poem is actually London. So the city nights are London city nights, and also terms like the lights or the clattering hoofs and the rhythm of festive nights would also show us that this is a poem about a city. So, basically, when we look at the poem's themes in more detail, we we can see that the theme in the first stanza is night. So the night is grey and misty, and the night also renders the embankment, the street, rather vague. So in a way, the light of the moon isn't able to penetrate the darkness of the night and light the streets brightly. So these, the trees that hold the night itself, also the moon, contribute to a rather gloomy atmosphere. It's an atmosphere of darkness and gloom. But at the same time, the first stanza then ends on the motif light. And so even in the first stanza, we see that there is a contrast between nature and city. Lights here lining the embankment are electrical lights, which at the time of the poem's composition had just been introduced in London. So the first stanza ends on light, and the second stanza then begins with the motif light. But there's some slight difference here. While the first stanza is rather calm and static, there is no movement in the first stanza, the second stanza then opens with an elliptical exclamation, the sudden racing lights. And so the light moves, the light, basically this is some kind of unexpected movement, which is then also joined by unexpected sounds. So there are clattering hoofs on paved streets, and that indicates that this is an urban setting because you couldn't find paved streets in the country at that time. And so the lights, the sounds also joined by the rhythm of festive nights, contrast the calm of the night and the misty greyness of the night of the first stanza. Indeed, this calm and static is, of the first stanza is broken by movement, by light, and by sounds, which then illustrate the urban atmosphere in the second stanza. So as you can see, the second stanza also ends on the motif night. And again, in both stanzas, we get a contrast between night and light in the first one and light and night in the second one. So when the third and the final stanza here picks up the motif night again, the atmosphere has changed. There are now gardens and there is a weeping moon. And so basically these emotional sighs of the gardens and the weeping of the moon further enhance the sad atmosphere and further increase the sad and gloomy atmosphere of the first stanza. So when we look at the relationship between the natural environment and the urban environment, which I have juxtaposed in this reading, we see that they raise different connotations and different contrasts. They raise contrasts between calmness and movement, between static and dynamic pictures, between stillness and sounds, and also between the sadness and joy. So I suggest that we can read City Nights as environmental literature, and that this allows for drawing conclusions about the cultural and the natural context of the poem. So the environment is illustrated as that which surrounds the speaker, and this is an important definition which we'll come back to, that the environment is not only the natural environment, but it is everything that surrounds the speaker. So in this case, the speaker is surrounded by trees, branches, gardens, and moon, by the natural environment on the one hand, and the speaker is also surrounded by paved streets, by electrical lights, by carriages, and by parties. So the speaker is surrounded by the urban environment as well. And so the speaker puts both in a contrastive relationship and illustrates how nature and the city are actually two entities, how these two environments do not go very well together. They contrast each other. One is sad, the other is joyful. And this creates a tension between the two. So one last word on this poem. What struck me most when I first read this is that basically there are no people in this poem. So even though the speaker is surrounded by natural and urban environment, there are no people, there is an absence of other city dwellers. The speaker, him or herself, we don't know what gender the speaker has, remains impersonal in this poem. She seems to look onto the scene from a position that could actually be compared to the position of the moon here, a very aloof and distanced position. And other people only appear as probably passengers in the carriages and probably as part of these rhythms of the festive nights. But apart from that, there are no actual people here. So it is based on this first reading of Arthur Symons' City Nights that I would like to continue by defining eco-criticism and to spell out in more detail what I have already done, actually, by reading this poem from an eco-critical perspective. And so, defining eco-criticism, I'd like to turn back to Jerry Glotfelty's eco-criticism reader. Here she says that, while eco-criticism is actually a response to the growing environmental concerns of our world, which I illustrated in the beginning, and well, on the one hand, she says that all ecological criticism shares the fundamental premise that human culture is connected to the physical world, affecting it and affected by it. This is an important phrase which you should keep in mind. The physical world and human culture affect one another in a reciprocal relationship. So eco-criticism takes as its subject interconnections between nature and culture. It is, on the one hand, a critical stance, and as such it has one foot in literature and the other on land, and also a theoretical discourse which negotiates between the human and the non-human. So basically this brings us to two key aspects of eco-criticism. One is the aspect of interconnectedness. And the first law of ecology states that everything is connected to everything else. So interconnectedness means that humans and their environment, and again, this is their environment in the sense of everything that surrounds them, have a relationship of, well, reciprocity of interconnection, because as our reading of Symons' poem has already illustrated, the natural and the urban and the urban environment have a very intricate, a very complex relationship, a relationship of contrasts, but also of tensions. And linked to this aspect of interconnectedness is the aspect of reciprocity. So this interconnectedness doesn't only work one way, but it always works both ways. As Rückert also spells out, in the ecosphere, in the environment, there is a reciprocal interdependence of one life process upon another, and there is a mutual connected development of all of the Earth's life systems. So in Symons' poem again, this reciprocity was illustrated by the mute presence of nature in the city, and also by the effects of urban life on the natural environment. What I'd like to spell out in more detail as we move along is actually what this might mean with regard to literary studies, and we'll discuss how literature fits into this eco-critical framework of interconnectedness and reciprocity. But before we do that, there are some things I would like to say about terminology. I've been using the terms the natural environment and the cultural environment without really specifying what I mean by them. These two aspects, nature and culture, also have a very special relationship. And this relationship raises some crucial follow-up questions. what we actually mean by nature and culture. So these are only three kinds of relationship that we could find between nature and culture. So first of all, as you can see, is there an opposition between nature and culture? Very often, nature and culture have been looked at in opposition, and this means that nature and culture are two opposing poles. They cannot come together, they cannot actually meet. But they are distinct, there are no overlaps between them. This is a very widespread assumption, and it dates back to Renaissance times. Nature is most often seen as wild, untamed, as barbarous, whereas culture is a rational and very refined product of civilization. So culture is an achievement of human evolution and development, and it includes all the material goods that human beings have made, their knowledge and their skills. And of course, these are very reductive definitions. It's just to make clear the opposition between the two. That doesn't take us very far. And it doesn't take us very far in an eco-critical approach, most of all. So the second approach would be what is called a deep ecological approach. And this approach would claim that everything is nature. So we as humans are part of nature too, because we depend on biological processes, we are natural beings. And also our houses and the city is natural too, because they are built from natural resources. And again, this doesn't take us very far. It is rather vague, and it is an approach that is not very often found in literature. The approach that is most often found in eco-critical studies is the third one, and that's the social constructionist perspective. On the one hand, it says that everything is culture, but I will spell this out in more detail, and I think the everything is culture will become a bit clearer then and a bit more fruitful for reading literature. Basically, what this approach means is that nature is something that is shaped by the way we see it, and by some kind of cultural preconditioning, by our socialization. This, of course, is very often ambiguous. So, on the one hand, nature could be associated with peace and calm. When you think of romantic poetry, and you think of Wordsworth's poems, for instance, you could think of nature as a source of inspiration, as a source of peace. But then you could look at dark woods, and you could think of dark woods as the setting for adventures. For instance, in Grimm's fairy tales, but also when you think of films such as The Blair Witch Project, they are in the midst of a very dark wood, and somehow this immediately triggers there will be an adventure of some sorts. Of course, everything is culture seems kind of strange. It seems like a strange claim, because after all, nature is something that is out there. So we can go out there and we can hug trees, we can pick flowers. Nature is something that is tangible. And so more recent approaches to this in the social constructionism have tried to solve this problem by taking into account the relationship between nature as something that is out there, something that we can touch, like trees and flowers and houses, and also the relationship between that tangible reality, the materiality of things, and on the other hand, between the meaning that we give these things. The meaning, for instance, that a dark wood is a site of adventures, or the meaning that a beautiful flower is romantic. I will not go into much more detail here. I think it's important to clarify these terms before we move on. And I think also that it is important to look at nature as something that we give meaning to, and that as something that not only we as people in our everyday lives give meaning to, but that also the poems we're going to look at gives meaning to. And this is something that can be achieved by this last approach here. So even in this last approach, the most important thing to bear in mind is the interconnectedness between nature and culture, and that there are certain relationships between them. The relationship between nature and culture still remains difficult. So here, Mainz says that man has kind of turned himself into the only speaking subject, as a self-proclaimed soliloquist of the world. Man is the one who uses his language as the point of intersection between his or her subjectivity and also between that which is to be known about nature. So in this view, then, nature can't speak to us in actual words. So this definition really posits a hierarchical relationship between nature and culture. And in this relationship, nature is the other. It is silent, it can't speak, and it only surrounds man. And, well, the gender issues here are actually worth noting. But man, he or she, is the only one who can speak about nature and who can actually give meaning to it. So in this relationship, what we will look at in more detail will be the relationship between man as the one who speaks and nature as the setting in which man is placed. So the relationship between human beings and the places they inhabit, in this case the city, will be of most importance in this lecture. And eco-criticism here attempts to find new ways of dealing with these relationships. It attempts to find ways of moving from the hierarchical relationship, man is the one who speaks and nature is silent, to an egalitarian relationship in which nature and culture can actually coexist. And as you can see when you look back to the opening, this becomes more and more important. My lecture deals with, as the reading of Simon's poem has already shown, the relationship between human beings and one very specific place they inhabit, which is the city. And in a way, this seems even stranger than looking at human beings, culture, and nature, because the city and eco-criticism might seem like a contradiction in terms, an oxymoron. So eco-criticism is concerned with the environment, and the city is one of the most typical expressions of culture. So it actually constitutes a very stark contrast with nature. And in fact, cities are often almost demonized as sick, monstrous, blighted, ecocidal, life-denying, parasitical. The city is everything that nature is not. And cities indeed seem very far removed from the natural. At the same time, cities are also very often linked to nature. So another tradition of urban ecology sees the city as maybe a rhetorical image, but after all, as an immense biological organism, which is at times hopelessly overextended, hopelessly too big, and totally beyond any carrying capacity or sustainable organization of resources. It is an organism that cannot survive on its own, but it depends on support from the surrounding nature and the surrounding farmland. And what this actually means, what the city is like, is spelled out in more detail by Hannah Wirth-Nesche, who then spells out that the urban environment has four different facets. The urban environment has a natural aspect to it. It has a built environment, it also has a human environment and a verbal environment. And as you can see, when we differentiated between the natural environment and the urban environment in the reading of Arthur Symons' poem, now there is a natural environment, and this is a continuous aspect here, but the urban environment is then spelled out in more detail. So the urban environment has suddenly four different facets rather than appearing as a monolithic entity as in the first reading. So let me spell this out in more detail. So Wirtnesche argues that the natural environment is nature incorporated into the city. Think back to Arthur Symons' poem, and we will look at another poem in a minute. Think back to Arthur Symons' poem. Think about the trees, the branches, and the moon. These are all elements of the natural environment that appear in the city. Then the built environment is rather obvious. It refers to the city's architecture and to its buildings. But also, when you think back to Symons' poems, it refers to the streets, anything that is built by the people who live in the city. The human environment, as I have said, was conspicuously absent from Symons' poem. There were no other people in the poem. But we could call the human environment the social aspect of urban life. So this social aspect would also include, for instance, the festive nights, the parties, the carriages, movement in the city. And finally, the verbal environment is what we will look at in more detail. It is urban poetry, for instance, or any verbal expressions, written or spoken expressions about the city. So this verbal environment is what we're going to look at in more detail when we look at urban poetry. So urban poetry is a subgenre of poetry that takes the city as a subject and the main theme. So basically, we will discuss urban poetry of London, and so we will look at poetry that takes the city of London as its subject, and we will look at how the four aspects of the urban environment, the natural, the built, the human, and the verbal, are actually present in these instances of urban poetry. There are certain relationships between these four facets of the city. As I said, urban poetry is part of the verbal environment, and this verbal environment then again represents the natural, the built, and the human environments of a given city, or in this case of London. What is important to bear in mind is that basically, these are representations. Along with this approach to nature and culture I outlined, along with this social constructionist approach, it is important to remember that this is not nature as such. This is a representation of the natural environment, of the built and the human environment. And therefore, as I put on the slide here, the urban environment in its facets is cast in a multiplicity of roles towards divergent ends and by different people, for instance, by the poem speakers. Okay, so this was, again, a fairly long theoretical part about eco-criticism and an eco-critical perspective in literary studies. What I'd like to continue doing is look at another poem now to see where this actually takes us, to look at how we can actually deal with an eco-critical perspective, how we can look at these different facets of the urban environment. The poem I'd like to look at is another poem from the modernist age. It is Amy Lowell's A London Thoroughfare at 2 a.m., which was published in 1914. This is a fairly long poem, and so I put it on a couple of slides. We will go through it step by step. And this is part of the first stanza. The first stanza is so long that it didn't fit on one slide. Again, you can find the poem on your handout. So in this first stanza, again, here's the key, and I kind of differentiated the key a bit more. So since this poem is an instance of the verbal environment, you can now find a key about the built environment, the human environment, and the natural environment. So in this first part of the first stanza, you can find the intricate interwovenness of the natural and the built environment. For instance, again, this poem describes a street at night, and the street is lit by lamps, the street glares it shines in the glare of lamps. However, these are actually cold white lamps, which is only part of the later stanzas, but we will look at that in more detail. So basically, the street as part of the built environment and the lamps as part of the built environment then contrast with parts of the human environment, the caps and the shuffling of feet. Basically, then the third thing we can find is also an image of the natural environment. Again, it's a river. So basically what we find here is the relationship, also a metaphorical relationship between the built environment and the natural environment. The street has just been watered. It has just been cleaned after the day's business. So this cleaning, this water makes it shine, but it also prompts the speaker's comparison of the street to a river. And as this poem juxtaposes elements of the built environment and the natural environment, it also creates a link between the two, of course, even though it then continues with a description of the human environment here, with the caps and the shuffling of feet, or in the next stanza, with the people who actually inhabit the city, who are actually part of the night in this city. So the people we can find here, the city dwellers who are out in the streets at night, are tramps dozing on the window ledges and night walkers. Again, from the point of view of the speaker in this poem, the presence of these people doesn't really contribute to a more homely and more comfortable atmosphere in the city, but rather the city is squalid and sinister, as you can see in the third line. And again, here, these elements of the built environment show that there is a juxtaposition of the two, which is not what I wanted to say just now. But you can see that it doesn't make them a more, the presence of these people doesn't make them the city a more comfortable place, but rather it increases the dark and gloomy atmosphere. So here, when we look at the built environment, and again we look at the natural environment, we can see that basically this metaphorical relationship between the built environment and the natural environment is taken up again, and it supports the atmosphere created in the reading here, the atmosphere of a gloomy and sinister place, because even comparing the street to the river doesn't provide any hope, and it doesn't provide any direction, because the street is merely a river that actually leads nowhere. So when we look at the second stanza, this is the entire second stanza on this slide. The darkness of the night doesn't seem so squalid and sinister anymore, and this is caused by the appearance of the moon again. So there is a full moon, and this moon renders the atmosphere less cold and dark. The night is not black anymore, but it is plum colored, so it is only a darker shade of blue. And the speaker returns to the image of the lamps here. So we can see the moon appear first, and the speaker returns to the lamps here, but still the lamps only cast a cold light. And what is striking to note, and what is striking to note is that basically the moon doesn't have any power over this urban environment. It doesn't have any power over the built environment, more specifically, because it is only thin and lusterless. The street, however, is brightly lit by these white lamps, and the moon doesn't have the power to really light the city on her own. At the same time, it is the moon that evokes warm feelings in the speaker. The speaker loves the moon, but its contrast with the built environment and also its contrast with the human environment of the first stanza, again, causes a feeling of alienation. This is an alien city. And so, again, this poem produces a contrast between the natural and the built environment, which is symbolized, for instance, through the juxtaposition of street and river, of lamps and the moon, of something that is unknown and cold, and something that is known and love, of something like the people in the street who are isolated and anonymous, and something that the speaker knows very well, which is the moon. So we could compare this poem to Arthur Symons' poem, which we discussed earlier on, and so it's significant to note that both poems depict the city at night. So both indicate that nature and the natural environment has lost its power in juxtaposition with the built environment. And this is indicated, for instance, by the sighing gardens and the weeping moon in Symons' poem, and here it is illustrated by the speaker's perception of the natural and the built environment. So these two poems that we just discussed here mainly dealt with the relationship between the natural and the built environment in an urban context. But also these issues can be linked to eco-criticism, so eco-criticism deals with these relationships. So we looked at two poems that had as their main theme the city in the modern period. And I would like to say very few things about the contextualization of these two poems. It is striking to note that basically at the turn of the 18th to the 19th century, cities had become the most popular life place of people in Great Britain. So so industrialization, which precedes modernism, has led to a rapid growth in the population of most cities. And this is a quotation taken from Peter Ackroyd's London, a Biography, which says that a population of 1 million at the beginning of the 19th century increased to approximately 5 million by its close at the time when Symons wrote his poem. And by 1911, by the time that Amy Lowell wrote her poem, the population had again risen to 7 million. So in this case, then, London became the largest city in the world and Great Britain the first urbanized society in the world. So the city is a very important place, and it also becomes an important subject of poetry, and therefore urban poetry actually came up in the modernist age. There is hardly any urban poetry in the Romantic period, in the period that precedes the modernist age. To say a bit more about cities at that time, it is interesting to look at Georg Simmel's essay Die Großstädte und das Geistesleben, which was published in 1903. So he raises some main aspects of the urban environment as a whole, he says that basically urban environment depends on finance and trade. It depends on the effective mastery of time and space. But also, because it is so effective and because it has such a bustling atmosphere, the urban environment produces an overflow of artificial stimuli. Living in the city, as opposed to living in the country, then means that the people in the city have to cope with these stimuli, and that seems rather difficult at that time in 1903. So most city dwellers need to shut off their senses towards these stimuli, and therefore the urban environment breeds indifference among its inhabitants. Indifference, on the one hand, towards their environment, but on the other hand, also indifference towards their fellow city dwellers. So this means that the urban environment is also characterized by anonymity and isolation. And one of the few things similar to say on the positive side, the urban environment also increases personal freedom because no one knows you. You can be whoever you want to be in the city. That's basically the gist of what he says. In modernism, of course, there are changes in attitude towards the natural environment. As I already said, on the one hand, there is a loss of nature as a source of inspiration and transcendence. So on the one hand, in the Romantic age, Wordsworth and other nature poets found inspiration and also a feeling of transcendence in nature. And this mainly goes back to the assumption that nature could not be tamed or bent to man's will, and therefore it was most of the time equated with God. But at the same time, then, around the turn of the century, then, industrialization had also reduced the fear of God in a way and brought better living conditions, so it was not necessary anymore to seek transcendence in nature. More recently, but also already starting in modernism, changes in attitude towards the urban environment that are related to the natural environment also include attempts at greening the urban environment and introducing or reintroducing nature into the cities, for instance, through gardens and parks and so on. Modernism is basically the main focus of my readings of urban poetry in this lecture. And while we looked at two poems by Simons and Lowell that actually illustrated these developments in a way, in one way or another, we can also see that eco-criticism has two different stances. On the one hand, it discusses the relationship between the natural environment and the city, as in the built, the human, and the verbal environment. But at the same time, another important issue, one that I actually started this lecture with, is the issue of pollution, and that's what I'd like to discuss now. And for discussing the issue of pollution, I chose two poems. One is a poem from the modernist era, and the other is a contemporary poem. So the first poem I'd like to look at is an excerpt of a very long poem. It is an excerpt from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland is a very complex poem. It is a seminal poem of modernist times, and it is impossible to really discuss that in any detail here. But the poem mainly represents the urban environment as a whole, as a deserted landscape. And we could read other excerpts from the poem and find abundant evidence of Eliot's depictions of the relationship between nature and the city. And that would resume our discussions of Lowell's poem and Simon's poem. But also Eliot, and perhaps for the first time in the history of urban poetry, touches on the issue of pollution, and this is the issue that, as I said, we will discuss from here onwards. So this is a rather short excerpt, and already the first two lines hint at pollution. The first two lines, the river sweats oil and tar. And again here, what is interesting is to look at the socio-cultural context of this poem. It was published in 1922. Well, Eliot took a long time writing it, many years, and then finally it was published after the First World War. And at that time, industrialization, the development of factories, had really progressed at a rapid pace, and many factories opened in London, mainly on the Isle of Dogs, which you can see in the last line here, which was a perfect spot by the river, because you could really dump waste, and particularly wastewater, into the river. So the river sweats oil and tar is a personification of the natural environment. When the speaker describes the river as sweating, he or she links the river to heavy work and attributes sweat as one particular physical effect of heavy work to the river. So that's a natural biological aspect. But at the same time, the river sweats oil and tar, and so these are two waste products of not the human body, but two waste products of industrial factories. And so the poem emphasizes here the aspect of industrial pollution and its effects on the river. So pollution is not described any further here, but industrialization and factories are described through words like barges in the third line, sailing on the river, also drifting logs, and by the location down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs. And this draws attention to the fact that this is a setting, an urban setting, in which heavy industry is actually present. So this is a very brief reading of only a very short excerpt of Eliot's Wasteland, which underlines some features of pollution that already appeared as early as in the modernist period. And so what I'd like to do is to conclude these close readings of poems with another poem, a contemporary poem by Benjamin Zephaniah, City River Blues. And again, I didn't bring any more film clips, but I did bring an audio file, since the poem is rather long, and again, let me try whether this works on first try now. Okay, since you have that on your handout too, I hope it wasn't too difficult to listen to the poet's accent. It's the poet himself who reads the poem here, who performs it actually. You can buy CDs with Benjamin Zephaniah's poems on them, and he has a lot of very socio-critical poems, not only about, well, I think this is actually his only poem about eco-criticism or about the environment. He has a lot more poems about racial issues, since he himself is a black British poet. So, like the other poems we discussed, this poem also interweaves images of the natural and the urban environment in complex ways. So when you look at the first stanza on the left, the speaker equates the river as part of the natural environment with inspiration, and he thus recalls the romantic perspective on nature as a source of possibly divine inspiration and as an enhancement of the qualities of the human mind. But this expectation is disappointed when the speaker actually arrives at the river. The river is not a site of revelation and inspiration. It is rather a very sad site of pollution. So all the fish in the river have died, and as life in and along the river is dying, there are also dead men boating, and as an indicator of some kind of very postmodern pollution, there is an abundance of condoms, possibly used condoms, that line the river. On the positive side, this might mean that at least some see the river as a romantic setting, but even on the negative side, still this leads to pollution and doesn't leave nature unspoiled, if you will. So in the second stanza then, the river, the speaker draws attention to a bloody smell that emanates from the river, and he can't really locate the smell, but still he describes the river in the third stanza as a shit-colored river. So smell and color also illustrate the pervasive pollution of the river here. In this third stanza, which begins with, "This is our river, it runs through our lives," the speaker emphasizes that the river still belongs to the people in London. So there are three repetitive phrases. In the first and in the third line, "This is our river." And then in the final line, "But it's ours." So this is a relationship of possession at first glance, but it also signals a responsibility for the river. The river runs through people's lives, and this illustrates that the natural environment has significance for the human environment, and therefore it also needs protection. The river can also speak here in the fourth stanza, and the fourth stanza then illustrates the significance for people here, particularly for the old boys who will meet where every river ends. You might know this saying here. But what the following stanzas then illustrate is, again, the significance of the river, again, as a source of inspiration, because Joe Public wrote songs, but also as a site of trade and commerce. This is a place where actually capitalism could develop, where trade could develop, and we heard earlier on about the factories. Then in the stanza on the right-hand side, pollution becomes a more concrete aspect. Before that, pollution was rather abstract. There wasn't an active agent who actually polluted the river. But here in this stanza, pollution is linked first to Hitler's bombs in the Second World War in the line, "Hitler bombed it." And this seems like a very drastic comparison, because in a way this links the destruction of Hitler's bombs to environmental pollution. And then, a destruction, of course, that then not only affects the river, but that it affects the entire city. It is not only one person or, Hitler who bombed the river, but the name Joe Bloggs, like Joe Public in the previous stanza, refers to the general public. So when you think of German expressions like Otto Normalverbraucher, Erika Mustermann, everyone, the general public, Joe Bloggs, bombs the river. And this is everyday pollution. Think back to the condoms. This is Joe Bloggs bombing the river. And this comparison or this term alludes to the omnipresence of destruction and pollution in the contemporary city. But apart from that, from this general public's share in the increasing pollution, the speaker then mentions another crucial factor that was already part of T.S. Eliot's poem. He mentions the factories that bombed the river every day and that cause a lot of pollution here. It is interesting to note that "Hitler bombed it," "Joe Bloggs bombed it" are two phrases, two lines in the poem in the past tense, whereas 100 factories bomb it every day is in the present tense, and this signals an ongoing and repetitive impact on the natural environment, which is caused by the human environment. The factories are part of the human environment and of the built environment here. When we look at the final stanza, this stanza then resumes the opening lines of the first stanza, "Went to the river seeking inspiration." So here, the intersections between the natural and the human environment emerge most clearly. In the first stanza, when you look at your handout, The speaker then describes his or her, probably his, observations of the river and pollution. But in this stanza, he describes the effects of this pollution on himself. So he got eco-depression. He is depressed by what he sees. And then when we think back about interconnectedness and reciprocity, this also means that this frustration is mirrored in the human environment because this eco-depression is reflected in the speaker's experience of racial discrimination when he gets stopped and searched. Coon is a derogatory term for black people, and when immediately he feels the effects of this pollution on his lungs. And all that then culminates in the statement that he got City River Blues, which gives the poem its title and also illustrates the speaker's sadness and disappointment about the relationship between the natural and the human environment in this poem. So, to conclude, we looked at four instances of London urban poetry and examined them from an eco-critical perspective. We looked at the relationship between nature and the city in Simon's and Lowell's poems, and we also looked at the issue of pollution in Eliot's poem and in Benjamin Zephaniah's poem here. So we can see that basically these relationships are themes and motifs in urban poetry that came up as early as in the modern period but continue to have an impact and a significance for today. In fact, their impact and significance has increased considering contemporary environmental issues. So what eco-criticism as a new approach does is that it expands the contextualizations of urban poetry from the socio-cultural environment, this is something that has often been done in literary studies, to the entire ecosphere, to including environmental concerns. It also shows us that everything is connected, that there is an interconnectedness and reciprocity. Basically, literature also forms part of the environment, particularly when you talk about cities. Literature is part of the urban environment. It enters an interconnected and reciprocal relationship with the other facets of the environment, of that which surrounds the text. What I haven't gone into much detail about is actually the issue of interdisciplinarity. Eco-criticism as a new approach also juxtaposes findings in the natural sciences, in ecological studies, with literary studies. So I kind of interwove them into my lecture here and referred to ecological studies, but one could do that in much more detail, and that could be an interesting topic for further research too. Theory into practice. This is the subtitle, but a very important subtitle of this lecture series. And I think that putting theory into practice is one thing that can be done in eco-criticism very easily. Eco-criticism has a political dimension, so it is useful for describing not only the facets of the urban environment, but also eco-criticism is the result of a growing political demand for collective action against climate change. And so, in turn, eco-criticism and reading literature from an eco-critical perspective also might facilitate and hopefully facilitates collective action. So we can see the issue of reciprocity here too, because eco-criticism comes from a political background, it also strives to have an impact on this political background. So this eco-critical perspective provides new insights into reading literature, and particularly into reading urban poetry. So it also challenges us to rephrase questions of meaning and truth into questions of practice, into questions of actually doing something, which Glenn Love spells out as turning questions of truth into questions of practice towards concreteness and adequacy, towards facts, towards action, and towards power. But at the same time, this then also has an ethical dimension, and I would like to conclude with this ethical dimension by again referring to two quotations. The first quotation is that, basically, the conceptual and practical problem is to find the grounds upon which the two communities, the human, the natural, can coexist, cooperate, and flourish in the biosphere. So when we look at that, it is important to develop ways of coexisting and of really taking into account this interconnectedness and reciprocity. And by returning to the opening of this lecture, to Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth, which, as I said, won an Academy Award in 2007, I would like to conclude with a short statement, or rather a very urgent appeal that Al Gore made when he came to the stage during the ceremony. And he said, "My fellow Americans, people all over the world, we need to solve the climate crisis. It's not a political issue, it's a moral issue. We have everything we need to get started, with the possible exception of the will to act. That's a renewable resource. Let's renew it." And I think that is also something that maybe an eco-critical perspective on literature might teach us and might come from our readings of this kind of literature and from this new and innovative theory. So thank you, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask them.